Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The month of March is marked as a time to celebrate women's history in America. For many, living legend Jewel Tice Williams is an important figure.
She's the founder of the legendary Los Angeles nightclub, The Catch One. For four decades, The Catch was a place where politicians and everyday people of all colors, cultures, and backgrounds could come together and dance the night away, and more importantly, be accepted.
Tice Williams opened the club in the mid-70s, a time when racism was still rampant, along with open discrimination against people of the LGBT community, even ahead of the AIDS crisis. As a lesbian in the African-American community, Williams says she saw the need to open a place that could serve as a sanctuary for everyone. The oldest black-owned disco in America was not just a place to dance, but a community hub that expanded into a vegan cafe and community health center.
A recent documentary, Jewel's Catch One, chronicles the club's and its owner's journey. It features interviews with Sharon Stone, Thea Austin, Thelma Houston, and many others. It was directed by C. Fitz, who came to Milwaukee for a screening last fall, along with Tice Williams and performer Thea Austin.
They joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio, and Fitz starts by explaining how Jewel and The Catch One caught her attention.
I met her 6 years ago, 6.5 years ago, 2010. I volunteered to do a short piece on her, 2-3 minutes, because she was being honored for her community service. And as I initially researched her before I met her, I was like, wow, this is a lot. And by the time I did meet her in April 2010, I was just shaking my head saying, I don't know how I'm going to fit all of this into 2 to 3 minutes. We need to do a documentary on you. And she agreed. And as I researched it even more, just the massive amounts of community service, all that she built, not only Catch One, but the vegan restaurant at the time, the clinic when she was 56 that she started, the Village Health Foundation. There's just so much to cover, and it was hard putting it into 84 minutes.
Exactly. Now, Jewel, documentaries are a very timely process. They're the span of what I assume at least months, maybe a year or
more.
It
took me six years.
6 years?
Six
so
years.
Getting to know
Fitz very patient.
Over, this whole thing over 6 years, why did you agree to take part in this project?
Well, I welcomed the fact that Fitz wanted to do it. And not only did she want to do it, but initially she financed it, she shot it, she narrated it. She was really involved in it, and how could I not, with someone wanting to really tell your story, feel like, well, maybe there is some importance to it. And little did I know that genius director-producer had crossed my path and was going to be not only doing the documentary for me, but become lifelong friends and associates, too. And that was an added bonus that I didn't expect at first.
Were you both nervous about anything at all?
Nervous about the volume of life, of service, of what she created, and trying to fit it into one film. And over the years, we collected such beautiful interviews, not only from patrons, but patients and celebrities, and it just kept growing. And the archival photos and footage and research, just that made me nervous because her life is so huge and it's undocumented. And it was my job to do a good job in telling the world about her voice that stood up against hate and racism and homophobia. So I was definitely nervous, but I'm happy with it.
Well, and that is such an important thing, to document these places and the people who support and run them. And it's been over 40 years or more that the Catch One has meant so much to not only patrons and friends, but the LGBT community, and then more importantly, the Black LGBT community. It really was the first place in LA for the Black gay community to go. So throughout all of it, what has the club meant for you, Jewel?
Well, it, needless to say, changed my life because I grew up, for 42 of my 77 years, this was an everyday thing of eating, drinking, sleeping, and living it. I was very, very involved in it. And as a result, I grew, with it. And you'll see, or whomever sees the film will note that there were a lot of challenges and obstacles and transformations just changing of ideas and thoughts about a lot of things that occurred with me, in addition to coming into a place where I liked me. And that, you know, came along with years and years of various kinds of help, of work, of change, of recovery, of spirituality. The list goes on and on, and all of those contributed to who I am today. And at the end of our interviewing for the documentary, Fitz asked me the question, what would you change about your life, you know? And there were some pretty horrendous things that happened over the years from early childhood on. And I was able to respond honestly that I wouldn't change anything, because that end result I'm pleased with. And I think I've worked on what it was that I came here for, and that was to help initiate change, not only for myself, but for others, and to, you know, help take care of the planet in a beneficial way.
Now, you yourself are the heart and soul, organs, blood, everything that kept this club running. But Thea, for you as a performer side of it, what are some of your favorite memories of performing at the Catch, and what made this space different compared to other venues that you've been?
Jules Catch One was an amazing place for people to celebrate life, celebrate music. She had the best DJ. They played the best music. And everyone was welcome, although it was established by Jewel for herself and the Black, lesbian, and gay community. It morphed beyond, I'm sure, what her initial dream was. She was providing a place of refuge for the community to be free, to celebrate life. For me to be welcome there, it represented a space of just high celebration in life, a place of non-discrimination. And people could just go there and dance and be free and enjoy life. And that's what it was for me initially. My friend DJ Wayne Williams brought me there, and we were both just patrons supporting Jewel's business and enjoying life there and the music. Eventually, after Rhythm as a Dancer came out, and I was welcomed by Jewel to perform there several times over the course of the 90s. And in the new millennium, I went to Jewel as a patient to the Village Healthcare Foundation. I had a busted knee. I had bronchitis, and she healed me via acupuncture, counseling, and Chinese herbal remedies. And so everything this lady does works. and through all the challenges, they, you know, of course, I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see the documentary, but they tried to burn her out. They tried to buy her out. They tried to police her out. And, you know, the list goes on and on for the various ways that people tried to block this woman's dreams and goals and all the strategies that she put forward to, you know, break down barriers of homophobia, of discrimination, and, you know, and ideas that people had that were very antiquated, that, you know, a Black woman from the neighborhood could not develop into a smart businesswoman and succeed. They tried to smash her dreams, and she just showed the world, you know, and thank God for Fitz that she saw to it that her life story is showed, because now we just attended the International Film Festival in London. So actually the world is seeing this woman's story, and it's a true testament of, as she would say, integrity and grit, you know. And that's a long answer to the question you asked me, but, you know, my heart is in it. And I know my heart's in the right place for, you know, supporting her and her club from the very beginning. There was always, for me, always goodness in it from the time I stepped into her club into this moment in NPR. Thank you for your question.
Absolutely. Yeah. Jewel, the club has, as you mentioned, gone through many transformations and many obstacles, especially at the beginning, with everything from police intimidation, arrests, arson, taking a couple of years to open up after that, the bureaucracy from the city, all the things that tried to keep the Catch closed. So throughout all of that, what was the source of your perseverance?
I would say that it was the spiritual connection, and then having parents that were dedicated to the success of their children, maybe not in terms of financial, but they wanted us all, and there were seven of us, to be educated, at least get our high school diplomas. And as it turns out, we all had some education, and several of us have advanced degrees, too. And they never gave up, you know, at a time from very, 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 very humble beginnings. And I won't go through the details of that, but to still every day push the possibility of hope and possibilities of achieving something, of making something out of yourself that they didn't have access to in their time and place, but they wanted it for us. And the way that they stood up, you know, my dad was a union representative at his job for the 35 years or so that he was there. And I didn't even know about it. I didn't know because he was real passive with my mom, especially. And then when I heard that he was out, you know, leading the union and marching against all of the things that we're talking about, you know, the racism and that, and discrimination with the elderly, because they wanted him to retire before his time. And so even though, you know, when I was a kid, might not have been aware of all of these things, the residue of it stayed with me, I think, from them just being tenacious and never giving up and would not let us give up under any circumstance.
That kind of family inherited work ethic.
There you go.
State of mind.
Oh, there was no such thing as leisure time. You know, we didn't go to movies. We didn't do any, you know, it had to be directed at either educating yourself or physical work or a job or something had to take place. So.
Okay. Now, with that hard work that goes into running and operating a club, you also have the other side of the patrons that come into the club every night that keep the money flowing and keep it going. But when you're struggling to reopen after the fire, you mentioned that, quote, it was a gay issue for the black people, and then it was a black and gay and female issue for the broader community. Do you find this true still today?
Sure. There's some of that exists. But for sure, also, there's been change, and there's been growth, and there's been an increase of compassion. When we see the news and we see Black Lives Matter and we see Asians and Hispanics and blacks and whites, the millennium kids are on it, you know. So the change has filtered down to them and broadened to the fact to indicate that it's real and it's really a part of a lot of young kids, whereas before, their parents maybe did not feel the same way that they did. And of course, their grandparents for sure almost did not feel the same. So we have a lovely mixture in television, which has been a great influence in that on a lot of people, the masses, period, with their showing of more blacks and more gays and lesbians involved in the 8 o'clock shows, 9 o'clock shows, has I think changed a lot of folks' thinking when they can see real people doing you know, real things that they can identify with.
Another thing that brought the LGBT community and just the whole nightclub scene into the news in one of the worst way possible was the Pulse nightclub shooting. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, you know, nothing to that extent has happened before or with your club, but, you know, there were some obstacles and obvious hatred towards the community. How do you feel now that your club has closed its doors on the role of LGBT clubs for people? Because it's obviously much more than a place to go and drink and dance.
Yes. I had thoughts and did protective things while I had the club to avoid incidences like the Pulse from happening. And I don't know whether they worked or not, or I was lucky or whatever, but we did not have that. You know, I'd installed one of the metal detectors if I had all the money that I spent on security over the years, I wouldn't have to worry about, and the community wouldn't have to. I think I would have had enough to support most of the organizations in the community, too. But it was about the safety, and that came first. You know, we even went to the point of if there was someone that appeared to be unsavory or that was acting out in that, they were removed immediately. If we saw one of our regulars leaving with someone that nobody knows and maybe they were intoxicated or just not using good judgment by wanting to leave with that person, then we wouldn't let them leave, you know, and there would be folks that would report that.
Now, Fitz, as you've been involved in this project and getting insight into Jewel's life and the life of the catch itself, what lessons did you learn from Jewel and what she's built?
That patience, tenacity, and perseverance pays off. I don't know how she stood up by herself to everything that she did and kept going after being burned down, after the city wouldn't give her permits, just roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And she just kept figuring out how to open that club, open the doors on a tiny budget, and then also simultaneously build organizations like the AIDS Minority Project, because that's what was desperately needed for her community right then and there. And Ruse House, the shelter for women with AIDS and their kids. She just kept opening the doors and kept building. And so it's patience and perseverance, just like my documentary, 6 years. I never thought it would take 6 years. It's a perfect, in my mind, testament to her life so far, because she just opened a new clinic. And, you know, we could make a mini series out of it. The hardest thing was letting some of the footage go and drop to the edit floor, for sure. But it took a while to do it properly and hang in there just like she did for her community and keep making it right, making it better, making the film better, a better history lesson that's never been written before. So, yeah, patience and perseverance.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, there's a second community clinic opening up, and I was personally in awe and fascinated by the expansion of the catch. You know, you built this whole corner community that was so much more than the club. And I was also curious as to why you went and got your master's in Chinese medicine, and how has practicing medicine fulfilled you in a different way compared to your role as a leader of the Catch One?
Well, I'll start off with it's pretty much the same, you know, as far as contributing to the health and welfare of the community. In Chinese medicine, we have what we call the three bao, or the three treasures, where the mind, body, and spirit are connected. And even with the points that we use and the herbs that we use, they all have emotional and spiritual as well as physical importance in using them. So I feel like it's just a continuation or an expansion as it was when I had the catch open, of wanting to help more, an extension on providing care for folks that had AIDS and HIV. In fact, that was the first thing that first disease that I treated was that one. But it's all about the healing, and you can't separate it out. For those same reasons, we had a Black men's rap group, and we had an African American women's social group that met, that dealt with the problems in that in the Black lesbian community, and we had 12-step recovery groups of all types, from Cocaine Anonymous to Alcoholics Anonymous to adult children of alcoholics, and a couple of others that, you know, sexual addictions and that sort of thing. So in order to be whole, it can't be all about the dance either. It has to be when you leave Catch One that you took that feeling out with you into the community about other things that are as important. So at 56, I was concerned, too, for my own well-being, because I have and had in the past, when things get too familiar, too common, and too easy, then I'll want to do something else. And sometimes the something else was not the best thing for me. So I had this feeling from the time I was a kid at 11 to somehow work herbs and lifestyle changes and that sort of thing into my own life as well as passing that information on. So at 56, I decided to go back to school, and through advice from my psychologist, he suggested, because he was seeing a patient that did acupuncture and herbs, to follow that. And I was real happy that he suggested it, because I love it. I love it. I think it's magical, the medicine.
Well, and it's, I'm sure, touched people beyond the dance floor, as you said. Things need to impact you when you stop dancing.
Yeah.
And the film touches upon your time with drug and alcohol abuse, and you've since been sober, and you said in the film, you know, the high you chase now is helping others. And I was wondering, as a club owner and just as an outsider looking in, a club can be a source of community and a safe place, but it can also be one that can facilitate drinking and drugs. And as you were going through your difficult time with substance abuse, did your perspective about the club or your relationship with it change?
Well, yeah, because I changed. But and until I started recovery, then, of course, I didn't have AA meetings and that sort of thing there. But I respect the ability of folks to choose what they want to do. And then I also knew that we, you know, obeyed the laws, which meant that we couldn't have folks that were drunk on the premises drinking. And because of the close watch that I had over my establishment all the time, then I tried not to break any of the laws. So staying in the confines of not letting anyone drink too much was part of what was already going on before I became sober, which was like 30 years ago. And I was pleased at the way that I was able to become sober, because I was afraid that once I stopped drinking and using, that, you know, how was I going to have fun?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I found out that I could actually still, you know, talk to people and still have fun, still dance, and still, you know, be crazy like I like being most of the time, you know. And not puffed up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The catch was referred to as a victory for every person in town in LA, and how it affected them during its season. And as now you've gone around telling the story of the catch and it's now closed, how do you both feel revisiting the catch's history and even your history of the two of you and your relationship over the past 6 years making this film? What new things have you noticed as you've gone around, or different perspectives from different global audiences?
It's been pretty amazing. And not only just Los Angeles audiences, but audiences on the East Coast and now abroad, leaving the film inspired just by watching her life, her incredible life of 42 years, and all the things that she accomplished. So the film is really an unwritten textbook. It's an example of how one person can make a difference, how they can take their life and serve their community in a lot of different ways. So just in her life, she's giving you lots of ideas and examples of things you can do. She did them all because she's Jewel Tice Williams. But having people watch the film, watch Jewel's life, and then leaving inspired, especially now in the shadow of Orlando and senseless shootings and everything that's going on in the world today, to be a global example has been an honor as a film, and also show the world Jewel's voice and hopefully touch some people, inspire some people, and give them a voice within themselves, because we all can do a little more.
And how about for you, Jewel?
Well, it's been something that I never imagined. It was not in my vision of things to have the the film, and then since then the acceptance by the audiences, you know, wherever, because even though society has changed and moved forward, there's always going to be, as we can witness by this presidential election, that there's still a whole bunch of people that don't like black folk and don't like gay folk and don't like poor folk. You know, it goes on and on. And I was really surprised at the numbers that have come out, you know, expressing that whatever gains that we've made have not been, in my estimation, as big as I thought or hoped they would be. So with the film, we've gone and played to very, very receptive audiences. And I've been able to see how it could be helpful to several different segments of the population, and especially to gays and lesbians that still feel like they're outside of the loop. And I don't propose that we assimilate. You had asked about having gay and lesbian clubs. I think that there's still a place for that, as well as gay and lesbian organizations that actually, you know, support and want more of the American dream. So it's been awakening for me to see that there are various areas of my life that are represented, thanks to Fitz in this film, that can help society as a whole. And among them would be those of entrepreneurial grit, of visioning of and following through your visions no matter how long. Because I first thought about the herbs and practiced that stuff when I was an 11-year-old kid, but it wasn't until 50, 60 years later that I was actually able to do that. So never giving up on what it is that you want for yourself and for others, especially if it's worthwhile enough that it could affect and change as many people as possible from their insecurities, from depression, from hopelessness, and to making that a positive experience and say, oh, I'm not too old. Yeah, I just turned 60, but she didn't finish school until she was 60. So maybe I can still be that artist that I wanted to be. Maybe I can still be the nurse that I wanted. So opening folks' eyes to various and sundry opportunities, as well as giving them, as Fitz stated, a reason to want to do more.
We're calling it hashtag Jules Revolution.
It's very fitting, I think. Yeah, certainly the documentary Jules Catch One, and the way you built it up, and the club itself, and the film, you know, everything goes beyond the dance floor and beyond the screen. In this case, I want to thank you all, Fitz,
thank
Jewel,
you.
And Thea, for coming in today. It was a pleasure to have all of you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thanks for the invite. It was great. Very cathartic.
C. Fitz is the director, and Jewel Tice Williams is the subject of the documentary Jewels Catch One. Fitz, Tice Williams, and performer Thea Austin join Audrey Nowakowski in the studio when the documentary was screened in Milwaukee during last fall's LGBT Film Festival.